Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, August 27th, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Anna Lisa Cox, author of The Bone and Sinew of the Land, America's Forgotten Black Pioneers, and the Struggle for Equality. Also on the program today, well, nothing. Today is the first of our vacation days here at the Majority Report, the annual final week of August, trying to lead the most French life that we can here at the Majority Report. We've all gone down to the south of France as a team. The entire Majority Report studio, we've all gone down to... we're just staying just east of Cannes at a French place. And we're sitting now probably on some deck having a glass of rosé Provençal from Provence.
I thought you were going to say argument.
And we're arguing. In fact, right now we're probably all wondering, why did we do this? Why did we...
More of each other.
Why did we take a vacation together as a group? And why France? Who here speaks French? No one answers.
Un peu.
Right. Un petit peu? Très bien. Folks, it's our vacation. And we have for you, though, brand new interviews every single day of this week. You're going to love them. This one with Anna Lisa Cox, a story of essentially a completely forgotten episode of our history that involved tens of thousands of free black farmers in what was the Northwest Territory at the time. Now we know it as the Midwest. Like Ohio and, Michigan around there. And, fascinating, story. And we'll also have a Matt's pick for a, deep archive show from the Majority Report vaults. But this week we're going to have, and maybe we'll actually, I had contemplated this, Matt, and I forgot to even tell you about this, but we've got to play maybe a redo of one of the Walter Block interviews because we have a lot of new listeners. They've never heard this stuff. So maybe that'll happen this week. But we're going to have interviews this week about international neoliberalism. We're going to have interviews about radical environmentalism. We're going to have interviews about mesmerism. We're going to have interviews about a memoir of an African American man who grew up in some of the poorest parts of this country. Or maybe one of those will drop out. We'll do libertarian thing. But folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. We can't do it without you. You can become a member for just literally for, I want to say pennies a day, but it really is closer to a handful of dimes a day. Not a full handful. Actually, that would be a lot of money. It's actually it takes only... four dimes a day, somewhere around there. Four dimes a day, you can support this program. Want to also let you know that when I take a trip, as I have actually not with the Majority Report kids, but with my own kids, we've gone to the beach. I always, now have the ability to bring an electric toothbrush because of Quip. The fact is, most of us are brushing our teeth wrong. Not me, but you. Maybe you, Matt. You're not doing it long enough, or you forget to change your toothbrush. When was the last time you changed your toothbrush?
When Quip sent me my replacement brush head.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, fair enough. But for the rest of you guys, that's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. Quip is an electric toothbrush, costs a fraction of the bulkier brushes. It packs the right amount of vibrations to clean your teeth. It is a beautiful piece of design, and it fits in your Dob kit super easy and in your regular, you know, toothbrush holders. That's a big deal, because the bottom line is you want to use it. If you do not use your electric toothbrush, it is useless. And for a long time, couldn't get my kids to use their electric toothbrush. I didn't use mine. With Quip, I do. The built-in timer and guiding pulses help you clean for the full dentist recommended 2 minutes. Their subscription plan is built for your health, delivering new brush heads every 3 months for just $5, including free worldwide shipping. That is why Matt, classic, non-replaces toothbrush at the proper intervals has done it. And it also comes with a suction mount. You can unstick it, use it as a cover for hygienic travel or to put it up on your bathroom mirror. Everybody loves Quip. They were on Oprah's O-Lift. They were named Time's Best Invention and the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. They're even backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, hundreds of thousands of happy brushers. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you'll get your first refill pack free. Matt did, with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/majority. I'm going to spell it out for you. GETQUIP.com/majority. All right, quick break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking to Anna Lisa Cox about this hidden history, the bone and sinew of the land, America's forgotten black pioneers, and the struggle for equality. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program fellow at Harvard's Hutchins Center for African and African-American Research and the author of The Bone and Sinew of the Land, the Unfairly Forgotten Story of African-American Pioneers. Anna Lisa Cox, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So let's, and I should say it's actually your subtitle of your book is America's Forgotten Black Pioneers and the Struggle for Equality. But it is a forgotten story of African-American pioneers nonetheless. So let's just start where we're talking about. What period of time have you examined here?
Well, it's much, much earlier than anyone has acknowledged or recognized. So this is right after the American Revolution. So, you know, for all of those Hamilton fans out there, this is your bag. So this is the period right after the American Revolution all the way to the Civil War. So the assumption has long been that this region of land, which honestly, I know, is often called the flyover zone, right? For all the coastal livers in America, but more commonly called the Midwest. But at the time that this history is taking place, it is called the Great West, capital G, capital W. It's actually our first free frontier. If you look at maps from the 1790s, this is before the Louisiana Purchase. So this space makes sort of doubles the size of the 13 colonies. It's a massive piece of land. And in 1787, there's an ordinance written for it at the same time that our national constitution is being written. But in many ways, this ordinance is the best ideals of the American Revolution put down on paper. It's only 4 pages long. And the people who wrote it had to deal with a lot less cooks in the kitchen than the people who wrote our national constitution. So they had a lot more leeway. And so two of the things that they did that were truly revolutionary is that they made it free of slavery, which made it the largest piece of the New World to be set aside as free from slavery up until that point, the previous one being Georgia, but that's a whole different story. Mm-hmm. So this is the Northwest Territory, and not only is it free from slavery, it has equal voting rights. Now, you know, to be fair, you had to be a man, you had to be over the age of 21, you had to own land, but it didn't matter whether you were white or black. You could vote. And this may sound really strange for the 18th century, right? Except that we've lost so much of our American history that another fact that we've kind of lost is that by 1792, when George Washington ran for president his second term, the vast majority of American states had equal voting rights for black and white men, including a lot of slaveholding states. So unless we can unbury, uncover, and reclaim this lost history, not only of the revolutionary moves forward that were being made for equality and freedom in this nation early, early on, but also this massive first great migration, the movement of tens of thousands of free African Americans onto this free frontier, starting in the late 18th century, we lose a lot of guideposts about where our nation has been and, honestly, where it's going today.
Well, the thing that really I find fascinating about this, and I have half a dozen questions just on what you just said, but the thing that I think it really shows is that you can go backwards. And, you know, like we have this perspective of history and of, I guess, some sense of enlightenment, moving slowly forward. But you can go backwards. And that's what I find absolutely fascinating about this. So we should just say, so when we say Northwest Territory, just so that we're clear, we're talking like Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, right? Indiana.
Right.
This is Ohio.
Right.
So it was Northwest Territory in the late 1700s, as opposed to, you know, I think people today, when you hear Northwest Territory, they assume, you know, it must be, Washington State or something like that. How is it, like, how did, were these African American, essentially pioneers, who were homesteaders, where did they come from? Like, were they freed slaves? Were they folks who had purchased their own freedom? I mean, who where did this population come from?
Well, this was a really, really fascinating group of people, and they were so diverse. There were just so many varieties of people. Now, very, very few African-descended people arrived on these shores free, right? So let's be really clear about that. But for some of these pioneers, they had been free in the New World, in America, long before there was a United States. By starting the 1600s, there are people who are arriving on this frontier whose fathers fought in the American Revolution as patriots, who they themselves fought in the War of 1812, all up and down the Wabash River, including in the Battle of Tippecanoe. And so these are incredibly patriotic and deeply American individuals. Many of them were a fascinating group, which I have termed freedom entrepreneurs. So these are people who were working overtime in slavery, as enslaved people, to gain extra money in order to purchase their freedom. And this was a really tough thing to do because you can't exactly negotiate with a person who owns you and your labor, right? So oftentimes they're being charged usury rates, like double the market value for themselves. And once they came up with the money, it could just be taken, by the person who enslaved them, right? And
right.
and the entire thing. I mean, the whole thing was set up for corruption. But actually, there were thousands of these freedom entrepreneurs who were coming onto this Northwest territorial frontier long before the Civil War. And as I describe in my book, The Bone and Sinew of the Land, they are rejecting the culture that they came from. So they're coming from this culture, this enslaving culture. Some of them are actually being sold by their own family members, by their fathers, by their half-brothers, by their own cousins, all of whom are white, and who consider themselves owners of these blood relatives of themselves. But they are prioritizing profit over family. So these whites are selling their own kin in order to make money. And those kinfolk are then deciding to reject that culture and prioritize family over profit. So they are coming to the frontier, having purchased their freedom, and then they are homesteading land, purchasing land from the federal government, really good land, they're farming it well, and then as they make money as farmers, they are purchasing their family's freedom, their daughters and their wives and their mothers, and they are putting back their families again.
Fascinating. And we're talking about, is it 63,000 people at this time?
This is, by 1860, there are over 63,000 African-descended people in this region who are counted. And I want to stress the word counted, because this is a federal document. And problems with the census and race are not new.
Right.
And problems with the federal government and race are not new. So there were some of these African-descended pioneers who refused to be counted on the federal census record, especially after the horrific law, the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law, was passed, which took away their right to habeas corpus and a right to trial by jury. And there were some people like John Langston, who was the first African-American to be elected to political office in this nation in a free and open election. And yes, he was living on a successful large farm that he owned in rural Ohio. He wasn't living in Boston or New York. That first was from this region, and he refused to allow himself to be counted in the federal census, even though he was a young lawyer, the first African-American lawyer to become a lawyer in the state of Ohio. He did it out of protest for what the federal government was doing. So I want to say the number 63,000 is very conservative. It's also a state's worth, because the Northwest Territorial Ordinance of 1787 clearly outlines that in order to become a state, a region of the territory must have at least 60,000 non-native people living in it in order to become a state. So this is over a state's worth of free African Americans living integrated and scattered across this region. And the fact that we have lost this history, it still baffles me. I love talking with high school students about this history. And the other day I was in Brooklyn talking to a group of brilliant young high school students at Boys Hope, Girls Hope. And we were talking about sort of how we could compare this lost history, and saying it would be a little bit like in a few weeks. Okay, just imagine. This is just pretend, right? Don't be alarmed, folks. But if in a few weeks the federal government decided to make it illegal for anybody of African descent to play professional sports in America, say somebody got upset about the Take a Knee movement or something, and this law was passed. So all of a sudden, no one of African descent is allowed, we're imagining, right, is no longer allowed to play professional sports. Then, spool forward a century or 150 years, and the fact that there had been successful athletes, the fact that there had been a Venus Williams or LeBron James, has been forgotten amongst the society at large. And historians are now arguing that African Americans have never been good at sports.
Right.
And that's what the textbooks say too. And so if then an historian all of a sudden says, oh, there was this person called Venus Williams and this person called LeBron James who were extraordinary sports folks and athletes 150 years ago, what if the nation at that point said, oh, well, so what? You know, what does that mean? Well, when you lose an aspect of the American past that is this large, that a nation loses a sense of identity of what it can be, who it is now and who it can be. And so this history, I've done my best to unbury it, and it took a lot of work, it took a lot of digging. Well, but it also has to be reclaimed.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, just what is the analogy to that in the analogy you just gave? What was analogous in that time to that law that said African American people can't play sports? I mean, what was it that, so you've got, you know, a 70-year period of what appears to be, you know, almost full, I mean, would you describe it as basically full rights that are afforded black folk during this time?
No. So here's the interesting thing. So the Northwest Territorial Ordinance, and if anybody wants to look it up, it's up on the Library of Congress website, and if anybody can find the word white in that document, I'll give them $5. I promise. I'm good for it.
Okay.
But it's the word white is left out of that document deliberately because entire states, recent colonies, are removing the word white from their state constitutions, including Georgia, which is really shocking, in order to open up equal rights to people of African descent. And this is all happening in the late 18th century. So this is the founding law for this entire region. But as each state is carved out of this region, the white majority in those states institute prejudice into their laws. So Ohio's the first, around 1803, they add the word white into their state constitution, thus excluding the African American pioneers who are already in that region, who are already succeeding. And this is what I want to stress, that the racism that arose in this region arose in the face of black success, not the face of black failure. This is really, really important for us to remember today, especially when we think about things like anti-immigration laws and the way and boundaries and borders. Because the first anti-immigration laws passed in this nation were passed against African Americans in the Midwest before the Civil War. The entire state of Illinois and the entire state of Indiana banned further African American immigration after whites in that region started coming in and discovering that African Americans had come in early, had gotten really good land, and were succeeding massively. I mean, these were hugely wealthy and successful farms scattered across this region.
Wow. And so as these as more white people enter into this territory, they hit the threshold to create they have the density, I guess, to apply and then get statehood. They're adding this element to their constitution and to their laws, a race conscious, I guess, element. And so what are the series of laws that begin to, I mean, do these folks by the late 1800s, by the time we get to the or mid to late 1800s, we get to the Civil War, have they been dispossessed of this property? I mean, it's an amazing story because when you look at, you know, the one of the fundamental disadvantages that black people have had in this country in terms of building wealth has been, you know, an inability to own their own homes or to own essentially, you know, land and property. And so what happens? Once Ohio does that in 1803, and they do it, as you say, in as a weapon to, like, you know, to gain a competitive edge, it feels like.
Absolutely.
And so,
absolutely.
So what, yeah. what are they, what are those laws that are passed?
Well, you know, this is the really painful and difficult part, but it's a two-part story, right? It's a story of rising beyond what we have ever recognized or acknowledged in the American past, of African Americans rising and succeeding as a group across this region. And, you know, it's I was talking to somebody in Detroit the other day, and she said she was thinking about the book, and she said, farmers, farming, like, what does that have to do with anything today? But actually, in those days, the American dream was to own good land and farm it well. I mean, this is before there was a city of Chicago, before there was a city of Milwaukee, right? This is frontier. This is our nation's earliest frontier.
This is where wealth is built, right?
I mean, right. This is exactly, and we're watching it. You can watch it. I mean, in the book, and I want to be really clear, you know, you and I are having this kind of theoretical conversation, right? But this, I want to encourage your listeners that this book, I promise, it's not boring, right? It's these are really heroic individuals.
I think so, people are interested right now. I mean, of course, I'm maybe professionally deluded on a daily basis, but I mean, and yes, and you tell the stories of individuals, and you know, that you have dug up. But I think it's fascinating to know too that, you know, broadly speaking, there's this dispossession. And so, I mean, what are the laws, though, that, I mean, what type of laws are passed that fall from these rights being limited to white people? Like, what is the cascading things?
One of the earliest laws passed in what is at a certain point called the Indiana Territory, but included the entire Northwest Territory except for the state of Ohio. So we're talking Michigan, Illinois, Wisconsin, Indiana, like this just massive region. And this is really early. This is before this region even had states carved out of it. Governor William Henry Harrison passed a law with what I could say were some corrupt judges, not his own father-in-law, who was trying desperately hard to preserve liberty and freedom for all in this region. But the young William Henry Harrison managed to push through a law which said that people of African descent could not testify or take to court a white person. So this is called your word or your oath, right? But this means that if you're a wealthy African American farmer on 900 acres of land, you're basically a millionaire by today's standards. You're hiring almost everybody in your county to harvest your wheat every fall. I mean, white or black, you're kind of landed gentry, right? But you and your large family are all African American. And say a group of men come up to your house one evening and they walk into your barn and they take out your four best milk cows, and they walk away with them. Well, if the only witnesses to that act are you and your family members, you cannot take them to court, and you cannot testify against them. So it's extremely difficult to run any kind of business or be any kind of an entrepreneur if you lose your privilege to the court, right? So that's one of the earliest. And then there starts being anti-immigration laws, and these are always coded, right? The language, fake news isn't new. I'm just going to say this.
Right.
But the language in the newspapers is, oh, well, we want to keep fugitive slaves from the state, right, or from our regions. So there's things called black code bonds that are passed, and these say that if you're of African descent and you enter a state, you have to be registered with the local white county clerk, and you have to promise or even pay a $500 to $1,000 bond. Now, in 1810, 1820, 1830, this is a fortune.
Right.
To put this into perspective, $500 in 1825 was what it cost the city of New York to buy a fire engine. Well, admittedly, it's not a big motorized vehicle.
Right.
It's a wagon with brass buckets and a pump and hose that's going to be pulled by horses, but it's still an immensely expensive endeavor for the city of New York to do. But meanwhile, you're an African-American pioneer trying to make it, and you're being told, if you're going to come into the state and come with the money to purchase land, you also have to make sure you have $500 just lying around for your bond.
And we should
say, in Illinois, it was $1,000.
And presumably, this person has somehow managed to raise the money to free themselves, right? I mean, so it's
many
not like
them.
There's you are severely limiting the people that can enter in. And what impact did that have? I mean, because you've already got, right, by 1860, 63,000 people in that region. What impact did that have by keeping, I guess, more African-Americans out from that region?
So that is the million-dollar question, right? That's the what-if question. Historians love to ask these questions. We can't really know, but I think there's a map in the front of the book that starts to give an indication. The three border states, which are all along either?
Yep.
Yeah, that are all along the waterways. And this is before highways and trains and airplanes. So the way you want to get to where you're going is water. So the best land is going to be the land closest to the river. And the border states of Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois are the ones that are filling up with pioneers the quickest, black and white. But by 1860, the state of Illinois has half the number of African-American farming settlements that Ohio and Indiana have. And Illinois was the first to institute a $1,000 black code bond. So these absolutely had an impact. They had an effect. And we can't know, could there have been double? I mean, I found well over 300 of these settlements scattered across this region by the Civil War. Could there have been 600? Could there have been 1,000? Could there have been, you know, over 200,000 African-descended people or more living in this region if these laws had not been passed? I don't know if we can know that.
Right.
But they certainly had an effect.
So what happened to this wealth? I mean, did this wealth survive? I mean, you know, you've described at least in one instance where you have lost essentially the ability to protect your property, right? I mean, like people could just start building on your land, I guess, theoretically. And if you can't take them to court and you can't testify in court, you don't really have a way of protecting your wealth and your source of wealth. I mean, what happened to this wealth? Did any of that survive, or was it were people just dispossessed? Where did these folks go, or where did their, I guess, descendants go?
Well, some of them are still there, and I want to be clear. The Midwest, the Great West, the Northwest Territory is not monolithic. Each of these states, each of these regions, even each of these counties are different. So some had large, large settlements. Cass County, Michigan had over 600 African Americans living in it. This is a rural county in southern Michigan by 1860. And some of them, there were white neighbors who came in after these early African American pioneers who were tolerant. Some were actually welcoming. Some were allies. So while there was this kind of prejudice and racism that was rising, there was also resistance to it, and resistance in ways that the Northeast had already lost. So there were revolutionary schools being built in Indiana cornfields in the 1840s, which were collegiate boarding institutions that were not only integrated racially, but they were integrated with gender. I mean, the idea of educating young women for college in the 1840s is also revolutionary. But then it's also black and white teenagers, all boarding. I mean, they've got their own, you know, there's the boys' dorm and the girls' dorm, but they're dating. And this is all happening in the 1840s in rural Indiana at a time when in rural Connecticut, such a school for wealthy African-American girls was almost burned to the ground with them in their beds in order to shut that school down. So there were spaces and places for that wealth to be used. And that school was not started by whites. It was started by African-American farmers, wealthy farmers, using their money to start that school. These farmers were helping to found and run the Black Convention movement. Now, this is a movement that's been almost entirely lost to history. But this, these were annual conventions where African-Americans from across these states would gather and organize. They'd write articles for newspapers. They'd petition their local politicians. They would protest the loss of their voting rights and the loss of their equal rights. And in Ohio, they were so successful that they actually had some of the Black Code laws reversed by 1849 in that state. This is not a story just of overwhelming horror. This is a story of resistance to that. So, for example, John Langston, who was that, who actually happens to be Langston Hughes' great uncle, the famous poet, but when he ran for his position in rural Ohio in the 1850s, he was elected to that office by a mainly white electorate. And this complicates so many notions we have about white versus black and North versus South. All of this just gets hugely complicated in all of the variety of things that were happening. But there's so much by losing this population, by losing its history, we've lost all of that.
And so, but I mean, what do we have numbers on what survived? I mean, what, you know, would that school that you described, had that been founded by white people and had it been for white people, would that school now be a prestigious national, you know, well-known school, you know, or I mean, I guess this is what I'm asking is like,
yeah,
you know, to what extent was all this, you know, again, like, do we have a sense of whether or not this wealth was lost? Can we track it? I mean, do
you know, that is, I end my book with the Civil War, and I'm really curious about this, Sam. I'd like to know. I mean, I wish I could say that in the bone and sinew of the land that I was able to go right up to the present day, but that would have probably been about 10 books and
right,
wouldn't have been finished yet. So, but what I can say is not all of these communities are gone, but what arose in this region after the Civil War, and particularly with the rise of the Klan in
right,
the rural Midwest in the 1920s, I think that the word pogrom is not inappropriate. And so the level of violence, once they got their rights after the Civil War, and I often say, you know, I know that Abraham Lincoln was shot by a Southerner, but I often think about that speech he gave in which he, you know, he thinks it's his first speech after the Civil War. We all know it's his last speech, but he starts talking about opening up the vote to African Americans, and it could have just as easily been a white person from Illinois who shot him as a white Southerner, because
right,
that kind of equality was being resisted so fiercely. There had been such a fierce backlash in that region against those kind of rights.
I mean, in fact, we just earlier this week, from the time that we're recording this, we spoke to Linda Gordon, who has wrote a book about the second coming of the KKK in the 1920s, and the broad-based support, somewhere around 6 million people, maybe, who were identified as KKK at that time.
Many of them were in this region. Mm. And there's sort of an unbroken chain back to the Copperheads movement of the Civil War, which was a pro-Confederacy, pro-slavery whites in this region. And even before that, the mobocrats, what Abraham Lincoln in his first speech, truly his first speech as a young man in his 20s in Illinois, called the mobocrats, right? This is a movement in the 1830s that was sweeping all of the major urban areas of the North to destroy, and was highly organized, but it was to destroy African Americans rising in the cities of the North. So it was burning down schools, meeting halls, churches, middle class neighborhoods, even an orphanage. This is sweeping most of the major cities of the North in the 1830s. I mean, this is an aspect of the Jacksonian period that we've almost completely lost, but certainly is due some more similar looking at. So when we talk about the resurgence of the Klan in the 1920s, I would argue that that was maybe its third or fourth manifestation, right? But the Klan wasn't just Southern, and it wasn't even just Southern right after the Civil War. As I noted in my book, there was at least one case I've come across in Ohio right after the Civil War in the 1870s, where a wealthy African-American farmer in Dark County, Ohio, was asleep in his bed, and a group of men gathered around his home with white masks over their faces and started shooting into it and killed him.
Wow.
And his two children only managed to escape because they hid under their beds, and they were on the second story. But the local newspaper called it Klan activity. So this is, we really, you know, all I can do and all I can say is that in the bone and sinew of the land, I've done my best to start to resurrect this history. But it is going to take people picking it up, reading it, listening to it on audiobook, asking questions, starting discussions for us to really understand what we've lost and what we can learn about it today. But in terms of their wealth, where they are today, who they are today, that's something I'm really excited to see come to light. What I know is that some of these farming communities are still in existence. There are still Morrises in Illinois in the Wabash River Valley farming in the same county that the Morris family has farmed for over 200 years.
Mm.
Same in southwestern Indiana, Lyle Station, Indiana. African Americans are farming the same land that their families have farmed for over 150 years, and there's a history of African American land ownership and farming in that county that goes back well over 200 years. I could just start listing them, you know, Western Ohio. I've got that map, but Cass County, Michigan, they are still there. And despite the levels of violence that their communities experienced.
Well, I mean, it's one more, I guess, chapter in the repeated dynamic of the expansion of black rights or wealth in this country met with an equal and sometimes overpowering response by whites to attempt to sort of like reverse those gains. And it would be fascinating to know, too, about how successful, because it sounds like they were pretty... these white folk are pretty successful in inhibiting and I guess in many cases just stripping this accumulation of black wealth and rights.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason this history has been buried. I'm beginning to discover this. You know, the book has only been out, The Bone and Sinew of the Land has only been out about a month. But it's been really interesting to see the response, because In some of these communities in the Midwest that are overwhelmingly white, the response has been sort of to shut their ears to this, to ignore it, because histories like this don't stay buried without work.
Right.
I often say to people, you know, diversity is the baseline in this nation. It's a monolithic sort of the idea that the Midwest is, or the rural Midwest is homogeneous, right? Is a myth, but but B, a violently created homogeneity. I mean, there's the fact that there are whole swaths of the Midwest that are now, rural Midwest that are now mainly white, happened through violence, for a reason. And so then it's going to take work to reverse that, whether you're talking about a Fortune 500 company or a county in Michigan, or a school, right, or a community or a neighborhood. The lack of diversity takes real work to create a lack of diversity. It's amazing how easy diversity is if it's not resisted. Mm. It's funny because a lot of people I talk to act as if, well, you know, we got to have our diversity training. We got to work on making the workplace more diverse. I want to say, well, maybe if, you know, we have to look into why there is a lack of diversity in the first place. Because, and that's, I think this book really starts showing the roots of that. But so much is lost if we reverse diversity, right?
Well, Annalisa Cox, the book is The Bone and Sinew of the Land, America's Forgotten Black Pioneers and the Struggle for Equality. We will put a link at majority.fm. And thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Fascinating piece of history.
Well, thank you for helping to reveal it. I appreciate it.